Director Taylor Hackford's films include The Idolmaker, An Officer and a Gentleman, Against All Odds, White Knights, and the Chuck Berry documentary Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll. He also produced the hit film La Bamba. His new film, Everybody's All American, stars Dennis Quaid and Jessica Lange. Quaid plays a college football star and Lange his beauty queen sweetheart. The film spans over 25 years of their lives and follows the couple as he becomes washed up and she turns from a housewife to a successful businesswoman. The film includes several scenes that take place on the football field. In order to stage those scenes, Hackford watched NFL films and footage from the 50s of great running backs. Hackford says his football scenes had to look authentic to satisfy today's audiences.
America today is incredibly sophisticated when it comes to viewing football. Monday Night Football is one of the highest rated TV shows on. So, you know, 30 to 40 years ago, Hollywood could make a sports movie. And I don't want to mention specific films, but, you know, you put whatever star you want in the role of a great sports figure and either mad in the background or really have kind of phony action, and nobody believes it. You could get away with then. I don't think you can do that in today's film world. The audience is too sophisticated and will demand too much. And in this case, Gavin Gray, Dennis Quaid plays Gavin Gray, the Gray Ghost, the greatest running back of his generation. If you say that he's the greatest running back of his generation, the audience is going to demand to see it. You just can't say it.
You've had several films that have ended up with number one songs in them. Up Where We Belong from An Officer and a Gentleman, Against All Odds from the movie of the same name. La Bamba, the re-recording of the Ritchie Valens song, was a number one hit. Did you go for that in your new film as well? There's a song, I forget what it's called, that closes the close credits. Mm-hmm. I should say here that most of the music through the movie is New Orleans rock and roll from the period of the film.
Right.
So you're taking records that were popular during their time and signify the time. But at the end, for the close credit sequence, there's an original song, a duet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Certainly I believe in creating a new song to fit a film, to fit the emotional context of a film. And if you can cast it right with the singers and have that lead your film, it's a great kind of publicity ploy in the traditional sense, but if you get it out there and it's playing and they say it's a theme song from An Officer and a Gentleman or Against All Odds or La Bamba, it helps. However, this particular film was a little bit different. I had continued thinking in that idea, and that's what we set out to do. The problem is that Warner Brothers saw the film, liked it, and advanced its release by almost 2 months. And so you can't get the song out in front of the picture as you normally would.
Usually I think when there's a song associated with the movie and the song becomes a hit, there's a rock video released of the song as well, and that and that helps it become a hit. And it's usually scenes from the film. Now, I've seen many films where I thought, oh, this is the rock video sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly
right.
The tone changes a little bit, a song comes on, there's a lot of fast editing, and you know it's that 3 minutes is going to be lifted out and you're going to see it as a rock video. Is that the approach you take with your movies, or do you prefer to have excerpts of the film edit together in a new sequence for the video?
I don't like that at all. I don't do that in my films. What I've experimented with from the very beginning is trying to use contemporary music as dramatic underscore. I mean, there's a scene in Officer and Gentleman with Deborah Winger and Richard Gere at a jukebox where I'm playing Dire Straits' Tunnel of Love. And the song has an up-tempo part, it has a down-tempo part, it has a great guitar play-out at the end by Mark Knopfler. There's lyrics playing under a scene where Debringer and Richard Gere are talking in very quiet tones. Those things can't be lifted out as a video. Occasionally, I guess, if you were doing a dance film or something and there's a particular sequence, you can lift it out. But I eschew that. I don't like that. And, you know, the problem that happens... you start to hear these songs that don't fit the film, don't fit the emotional context of the film. They're just big groups that somebody has paid a lot of money for. And I also know all of a sudden if somebody says, oh, I got X, Y, or Z, you know, platinum artist. We paid them hundreds of thousands of dollars for this song. And I'm saying to myself, wait a minute, you know, those people haven't been in the studio for a long time. Basically, I know where they got that song. It's an outtake from the album. It wasn't good enough to go on their album, but they over-recorded it. They've got it sitting in their on their shelf. Some producer who doesn't know music comes up and says, gee, I want, you know, a platinum artist on in my film. And they say, you know, some enterprising manager says, fine, I just happen to have this original cut. And a lot of those end up in films, and therefore an audience is like hearing these things and saying, oh, come on, give me a break. These things don't fit in this film. What are they stuck here for? Audiences aren't dumb. I choose to think that the film, the songs in my film fit, and they fit because they were designed to go with the sequence and not to overpower that sequence.
Do you direct the rock videos?
I try to. I mean, you know, it's funny, you know, the idea of using the scenes, we kind of pioneered that with Officer and a Gentleman. Up Where We Belong literally was finished a few days before the film was released. There was no way to get that out in advance. That song came after the film. And at the time, we were sitting there, Joe Cocker was on tour, Jennifer Warrens was someplace else. I mean, we could not put the artists together. How do we get something out there? And this was at the beginning of the music video explosion. Well, we went in and cut a bunch of sequences from the film to the music. And it was one of the first, if not the first, video that literally went out there and did that.
So you did that for expediency, not because you thought it was a terrific
exactly.
idea.
We did it. It was, kind of the pioneering time.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequently, you know, you add the artist, and that's important, and that's good.
Your very first movie, you know, I should preface this by saying that you are one of the most successful at the box office film directors. Your first movie was a big flop, The Idolmaker. I happen to really like the film. It was about someone who really wanted to be a rock and roll star himself, but didn't quite have the looks to make it. So he started packaging all these other young, handsome men and making them rock and roll stars. That was what the movie was about. This was a big failure. Was it hard for you to get your second crack? It was a commercial failure, not a critical one.
Yeah, no, it's, well, listen, I come out of public television. That was my film school. I made a lot of documentaries.
I think of how many people in public television wish that they could
well, you know,
follow
it's funny.
In your footsteps.
Yeah, when I was an on-air reporter and investigative reporter and I was doing political documentaries, I was very happy doing that. And it was a terrific opportunity to kind of express myself on social issues and things that I was concerned with at the time. I kept finding that I was... As I learned more, I started to play with the images, and that's a little scary when you're a journalist. You don't want to do that. So when I moved to dramatic work, you know, it was a kind of dream come true. The Idolmaker, I would have paid them to do. You know, they gave me $4 million to make a movie about something I loved, you know, music, mm-hmm. and I thought was some interesting characters. But, you know, I didn't care if it was a success or not. I mean, the fact that I could go out there and make a film of my own that had a lot of me in it, I was pleased with. So when the film went out, and it happened to be released the same week as Heaven's Gate from United Artists, and, you know, I could see the looks on all the executives' faces. They didn't even know that our little $4 million film existed because they were looking at the Titanic sink. But, you know, the film was critically well-received. In Hollywood, if a young filmmaker gets an opportunity to actually make a film and people can see it and realize that it is well-made, you usually get your second shot.
I have one last question. You have become a producer as well as a director. You could probably be directing all the time if you wanted to. What are the pleasures of producing a film that you're not directing, a film such as La Bamba? I mean, I'm not asking you specifically about La Bamba, but why produce a film if you're not going to direct it?
Well, there are certain films that I shouldn't direct. I grew up to Richie Valens' music, but Luis Valdez should have directed that film. He did. He wrote it. He directed it. He is Chicano. He knows those roots. And, you know, what I was trying to do as a producer, I speak Spanish. I understand a certain amount about the Latin experience here and think that it's a very, you know, the thing that was important to me is I know there's an audience out there. Hollywood was ignoring that audience. I saw an opportunity as a producer, but I thought that Luis Valdez should make the statements because he's lived it. I tried to make that possible for him and help him make the film, but in that instance, he should direct it. I shouldn't. And that way, I think, the role of the producer.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Taylor Hackford is taking a break from directing and will produce a new film directed by Robert Wise. Hackford is the producer and director of Everybody's All-American, starring Dennis Quaid and Jessica Lange. This is Fresh Air.